WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band REM has a new CD. On this archive edition, we have an interview with its lead singer and songwriter, Michael Stipe. The band was formed in 1980, and for several years it was a critics' favorite with a devoted following among alternative rock listeners. But despite its emphasis on making non-commercial music, REM went on to become a commercial success. Last year, the band was thrown into a tailspin when its drummer, founding member Bill Berry, left. The band members say they used that as an opportunity to reinvent their sound. Let's hear a track from their new CD, Up. This is The Apologist. Michael Stipe has been an inspiration to musicians starting their own bands. Stipe recently paid tribute to the performer who most influenced him, Patti Smith. Last spring, when I spoke with him, he had published a book of photos that he took of Smith on tour. He wrote that he first found out about Patti Smith when he was 15 and stuck in high school detention hall. I asked him to tell the whole story.
There was an article that that the writer Lisa Robinson had written about the CBGB scene in New York, which was just starting, I think, in 74, 75 was when it really kicked in with Patti and bands like Television. And I think the Talking Heads and Blondie came a little bit later. But she wrote an article comparing that scene to the music of the time, saying that the music of the time was very technicolor and very blown out and very colorful, and this was very stripped down and visceral and raw, and much more like black and white TV, like a staticky old TV. And there was a photograph of Patti Smith leaning against a wall, looking at the camera, and the picture was so so haunting and so mesmerizing. I think I immediately felt, you know, like there was something here that was worth investigating, and so I started. Started trying to find out about this music and trying to find out about these people that were making it, and bought her first record the day it came out, and it was very epiphanal. I decided then and there that music was what I wanted to do with my life.
So at this point, did you have any sense that you could sing or that you could write songs?
Not really. I played accordion when I was in third grade. I really wanted to play organ, but they ran out of organ, so I played accordion, but I never really sang, you know, very much, and I didn't really have an idea of what I wanted to do with my life. But the punk ethic in the mid-70s, when all this stuff was going on, Patti Smith and Television are really the two bands that I look to. The ethic was kind of do-it-yourself, that anybody could do what they were doing. It didn't take a special person to do it, and I took that very literally and decided then and there at the age of 15 or 16 that I was going to be a singer.
Excuse me for being sidetracked here for a moment, but accordion, what were you playing on those accordion books? Did you have one of those beginning accordion books with the horrible songs in it?
I don't think I could read them. I mean, I don't think I could read the music. But my third grade class, Mrs. Swindle was our teacher, had a band, and we would play various songs of the day. I think the Green, Green Grass of Home and stuff like that. And me and my best friend, Mike Rooney, played accordion, and at one point, we asked Mrs. Swindle if we could yell things out because we weren't allowed to sing. We had to play the accordion. I guess that took greater concentration than singing. But we asked if we could yell things out like GoDaddy-O. And so the two of us would stand on the side, and in the middle of the green, green grass of home, we'd be like, yeah, man, yeah, GoDaddy-O.
Oh, that's really great.
That was my auspicious musical beginnings. But I just decided, I felt like I had discovered something that I felt very much a part of at that pretty young age, and I stuck to it.
In your book of photos of Patti Smith, you say that when you were 15 and you discovered her, you were a dork nerd. What qualified you for dork nerddom?
Well, I think I'm still kind of a geek, you know, and most of my really good friends are too. It's like there's that old adage that the world is divided into two types of people: those that snore and those that admit that they snore. Is that how it goes?
I don't know.
I can't remember. Anyway, I think we're all pretty geeky. You know, we're a pretty geeky species, and I'm just smart enough to admit it, I guess. But I didn't. You know, I think in high school I felt very much an outsider, and I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere. And this music gave me a place where I felt like I fit in.
Back in 1992, you told Rolling Stone magazine that no one has picked up on how much you've lifted from Patti Smith as a performer. What do you feel like you lifted from her as a performer?
Oh, well, just there were things about her vocal style that I really admired, and there was a certain freedom and looseness to almost a scatting quality that she has, and a fearlessness. I mean, more than anything, I think the fearlessness. That's not to say that throughout R.E.M.'s career I've really embodied that. I'm not sure that I have, but I think in moments here and there, we produce stuff that has that same energy to it. Some of my favorite songs are the ones that really just seem like I didn't even know what happened. Suddenly there was a song and there were words, and somewhere in some very obtuse way they made sense.
Well, I think it's time to listen to some more of your music, and I thought we'd start pretty close to the beginning and hear something from the first EP that R.E.M. released called Chronic Town. I think it was recorded in 81 and released in 82. And the song I thought we could hear from it is Wolves Lower. Would you say something about the song, about writing it, or about this moment in your life when it was recorded?
I don't really remember much about that. I was kind of nervous to be in the recording studio, and I hadn't really learned how to write words, so I'm not sure how many actual real words there are in the song, but it's got a nice vibe.
Well, let's hear it.
Okay.
Suspicion yourself, suspicion yourself, don't get caught. Suspicion yourself, suspicion yourself, let others out.
That's R.E.M., my guest, is singer Michael Stipe, singer and songwriter. So let's get back to when you were a teenager, when you just started singing. You were telling us that you didn't really think seriously about music till you were 15 and discovered Patti Smith. So when you started thinking that you were serious about music, what happened next? Did you start singing more?
Well, when I was 17, I guess, I answered an ad and joined a band that was, I guess, kind of like a punk rock cover band, pretty much. And we had a real good time. We never really played out in public very much. It was mostly just kind of a garage band. And then when I moved to Athens at the age of 18, I really, really wanted to find somebody that I could work with. And
this is Athens, Georgia, that you met.
Athens, Georgia, yeah. And that's when I met Peter Buck, and he was very resistant to the idea of forming a band because he felt like people in bands were assholes, and he didn't want to be that. And he also didn't feel like he was a very good guitar player, which at the time he wasn't. But I didn't know how to sing and had never written a song in my life. So after months of urging, he finally caved in, and we started R.E.M.
My guest is Michael Stipe of R.E.M. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Michael Stipe, recorded last spring. In some of R.E.M.'s earlier recordings, his voice was mixed behind the music. When I asked him why his voice wasn't more up front, he said it had to do with his own insecurity.
You know, at the time, in the early 80s, everyone was mixing the drums louder than the vocal, and I just thought that was really embarrassing. We didn't want to be a disco band, and I was somewhat reacting to the music of the day, but I was also just kind of embarrassed because I'd never really, you know, the thought process of being a singer, being in a band, putting out a record, and then it's like, oh, whoops, well, I've got to write words because people expect words, and then, oh, well, the words should make sense. And, I mean, if you listen to our records starting with Wolves Lower, which we just heard, and progressing, the first really three or four records, including Chronic Town, you're basically watching four guys learn how to write songs. And you're watching me learn how to write a lyric, and I find that kind of fascinating. You know, those records mean a whole lot to a lot of people. Sometimes they're a little hard for me to listen to, but I do appreciate them for what they are.
Right. I'm wondering if you were influenced by any soul singers too.
I think I must have been, but I can't think of anybody right on. My, growing up as a child, my parents were not huge music fans. It was like a lot of Gershwin and Mancini and the 1812 Overture with real cannons and what else?
Well, your father's in the military.
The Sound of Music, yeah.
Oh,
But we lived in Texas for a stint, and there was country radio, and that was bubblegum, when bubblegum pop radio was really big, and so that was certainly an influence. I didn't really have an older brother or sister that turned me on to the Beatles and turned me on to the Who and turned me on to all the music of the 60s. And so, you know, I kind of discovered stuff via radio as a child. And then really up until I found that magazine article on Hurt Horses, I was just kind of coasting along. I mean, I think before that, the only one musical artist that I thought was really interesting was Elton John. When Benny and the Jets came out, I thought that was one of the most amazing, and I still do. For me, Benny and the Jets and Rock On by David Essex are two of the most amazing, they'd be in my top 10 of best pop songs ever.
Now, I know because your father was in military, you moved around a lot as a kid, mm-hmm. as he got transferred to different military bases. What impact did it have on you to always be the new kid in the neighborhood?
Well, the positive aspects are that my family and I are very close, and when you're forced to make new friends fairly regularly, it kind of brings you together as a unit. I hate that word. Well, anyway, we were a great loving family and very close, and we still are, and that's about the greatest gift that could ever be given to me. Is to have my two sisters, my mom and dad, be very supportive and to unconditionally, you know, love me the way that they have all along. And, of course, that's returned.
When you started performing, what were your, like, rock values? You know, the things that you really loved about rock, the things that you never wanted to become that you'd seen other bands become?
My band always, I feel like a kind of like a broken record because I say this so much, but it's really the truth. We always kind of operated by process of negation. We knew everything that we didn't want to be, and the things that were left were our options. And we were fortunate enough to be a small band that had to work very, very hard to get to the place that we finally got to. And we also had no expectations, no goals. So every time that we had a success, it was kind of a surprise, and we were all kind of like thrown back by it. And it kind of took us to the top of the heap, which was a pretty cool place to be.
What didn't you want to be?
I didn't want to buy my own myth. I didn't want to be a cliche. I didn't want to be typical or mediocre.
Let me play another REM track, and I think I'll choose one of your most famous recordings, your big hit, Losing My Religion. Is there a story behind this song?
Yeah, I was embarrassed about it at the time, but I finally fessed up to being a huge fan of the song Every Breath You Take by The Police. And I thought that song was like really kind of an intense, it was a beautiful pop song, and it was very lovely, and but you could take it more than one way. It seemed very kind of creepy and obsessive on one hand, and very kind of like intense and loving on the other hand, and I wanted to write a song that was like that. So I wrote Losing My Religion.
Okay, well, this is it. That's REM, my guest is lead singer and songwriter Michael Stipe. You know, I think a lot of people have a personal story to tell about that song, particularly about the lines, "Oh no, I've said too much, I haven't said enough." I think a lot of people have stories about times when they really weren't sure about whether they've said too much or said enough. Do you have a story that matches with those lines?
Well, no, I didn't really take it from any real life situation. I just think it was more about fear of rejection, you know, and when you're like really crazy about somebody and you want to tell them, but you're trying to give them hints, and then they're maybe not getting it, or they're saying something back to you, and you're taking it the wrong way, and that's really, it's that kind of weird, uneasy area is what that song kind of covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very successful. I really like the song a lot.
Oh, me too. I'm glad you still like it. A lot of people get tired of their own hits. Then they get angry with you if you play them.
Yeah, no. It's a good song.
And you still play it in performances?
We try to. yeah, we do.
How do you think fame has affected the band? You know, you're talking about all the values you didn't want to have, and I think there are some values that become almost difficult to avoid once the spotlight hits.
Yeah. The guys have always been really supportive of me being the front person, and the fact that I would get more attention and I would be the one that photographers wanted to take pictures of or wanted to push to the front of the picture. And that I'm the one that gets recognized in restaurants or, you know, when we walk down the street or whatever. They've always been really, really supportive. I know that Bill, before he quit the band, our drummer, always said that he wouldn't trade places with me for anything in the world, and sometimes really felt sorry for me because he would be able to say, you know, he'd be able to say, call a restaurant and say, I'm in REM, or call, you know, the baseball people and say, I'd like tickets, I'm in REM, and they would give them to him, where he could go anonymously into that restaurant or into the baseball place. I maybe couldn't, and especially after Losing My Religion, because that was really, that was a song that really made us international, you know, pop stars, if you will. And at that point, you know, I really had to kind of come to terms with that, because I was being recognized just about everywhere that I went. And that can kind of throw you, you know.
Well, the shame.
But I had had whatever 13 years of being in a band and being a star in my own head. to kind of build up to that. So it wasn't that, you know, it wasn't that horrible.
Right. I'm sure, you know, like shaving your head also helped people recognize you.
Yeah, it was easier when I could grow my hair different lengths, but my hair started to fall out, so I shaved it off.
Right. You know, I think the word that's most often used to describe you is the word enigmatic.
I hate that word.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it's stupid. I mean, I hate that word. That word followed me for years and years and years. And, you know, I did say early on, and I did feel, and I still do, that, you know, an air of mystery around certainly a public figure, but also just in life, is not altogether a bad thing. That you don't ever want to really give everything away. And at whatever point you do, you know, it might be too much.
Michael Stipe recorded last spring after the publication of his book of photos of Patti Smith.